cleaned it up and made it truly safe. When you're dehydrated, you have dirtier blood, bottom line. And you don't want dirty blood. Thick and filled with an abundance of toxins and other troublemakers. It leads to the symptoms and conditions described in this chapter, as well as to symptoms and conditions with dedicated chapters later in parts 2 and 3. It all depends on which type of dirty blood you have. Energy issues. We don't want to confuse energy issues with fatigue, whether chronic fatigue, adrenal fatigue, neurological fatigue, or even a case of mild fatigue, the unknown causes of which you can read about in my earlier books. The type of energy issue I'm talking about here is very common in people at the beginning stages of sluggish liver. These are people who used to have all the energy in the world and could go all day long. Then, as the liver started to become burdened and dehydrated, they began to experience mild dirty blood syndrome, and their energy started to flag. For those who were used to going at 100 miles per hour with nothing stopping them from getting all of their tasks accomplished, this decrease in energy wouldn't be enough to stop them from going to the company baseball game or to send them to the doctor's office. It would be enough that they'd feel a lag at different points during the day when they least expected it. It's one of the very first signs of a dysfunctional liver that's resulted in dirty blood pumping through the body. When the heart must pump harder to send blood through the body, it's a new experience that can feel draining. Again, this isn't the fatigue of a highly active case of EBV causing ME, CFS, though it also doesn't mean someone doesn't have EBV hiding inside the liver, getting ready to make its move to the thyroid and create a case of Hashimoto's or a variety of mystery neurological symptoms. It's also not a metabolism problem. Metabolism is a term used all the time to cover up for what's not understood in the body, like undiscovered dirty blood syndrome. This energy issue is the type where someone's been skating by fairly well and is just starting to notice changes in stamina. In this case, changing the diet and cleaning up the liver and blood can bring her or his energy back pretty darn quickly. Whatever diet you choose in this case, even if it's not the right type for someone with serious symptoms and conditions, the liver will give you a standing ovation of thanks for the improvement. Dark under-eye circles. Dark circles under the eyes can start as early as childhood. A discerning parent will take a child to the doctor, asking what's causing them, and many pediatricians will say that it could be an allergy, perhaps an allergy to gluten. When adults notice their own dark under-eye circles, they'll also often ask why. Dark circles, they think, are normally reserved for mornings after late nights, working or partying, hangovers or maybe getting over the flu. So what's causing them if none of those are a factor? People will brush on concealer or visit a spa, throw some cucumbers on their eyes and wrap themselves in seaweed to address it, only it won't fix the problem. It's ironic because cucumbers and sea vegetables taken internally actually do contribute to healing. Sure, cucumber slices on the outside can get results for run-of-the-mill dark circles, like when someone is temporarily dehydrated from eating a toxic food, or staying up too late on a stressful night, or drinking too many martinis. Even sexual activity can bring on dark under-eye circles. And believe it or not, cucumbers applied on the eyes can actually bring some improvement. For the real, deep-seated reasons why people deal with chronic dark circles under the eyes, you need more than an external application of cucumber and seaweed. You need to drink cucumber juice for true hydration of the blood, lymph and liver and start adding some Atlantic dulse to your diet to draw out toxic heavy metals and other poisons while providing yourself with critical, life-sustaining minerals. Dark circles, or even sunken eyes for weeks or months, mean there's a hidden problem, a liver problem. It's true for children too. Dark under-eye circles, leading to a diagnosis of a gluten allergy or gut problem, only edge toward what's really going on. In truth, this symptom has everything to do with a toxic, dehydrated liver creating toxic, dirty blood. Where the skin is thin under the eyes, it gets dark because the blood flowing through is lacking oxygen and filled with poisons, both from present-day exposure and from the troublemakers we inherit through our family lines. As you'll hear in Chapter 28, PANDAS, jaundice and baby liver. Many children grow out of a sluggish liver. In that case, the dark circles disappear. Many people don't grow out of it, or they develop or redevelop a sluggish liver when they're older, at which point this symptom can affect adults. It's not a sign that your liver is failing you. It's a sign that your liver has struggled to stay in balance and protect the person it lives within, holding back as many toxins as it could, and at a certain point became so strained that it was forced to let some of them go. If you're thinking, "Well, I don't have dark under-eye circles, so I must not have dirty blood syndrome," not so fast. There are different levels and types of the toxins and other pesky presences that I call liver troublemakers. Some troublemakers can make dark circles appear. Some can be released from the liver into the bloodstream without creating dark circles and cause other problems instead. When the liver is sluggish, stagnant, troubled, and not performing to its full potential, it can release a whole cocktail of old and new troublemakers that can contribute to those smudges beneath the eyes. For example, pharmaceuticals are one of the troublemakers that can create dark circles. Even if you're not on them currently, medications you took years ago that your liver stored away at the time could be releasing into the bloodstream now. Toxic heavy metals can create a long-term shadow under the eye for children and adults too, as can the family of various pesticides. Gasoline and other petroleum exposure, solvents and conventional household cleaners can bring that darkness or even an indentation beneath the eye. So overall, dark under-eye circles mean we have some dirty blood on our hands. What determines how severe they are is hydration. Proper hydration on a daily basis can help clean up dirty blood and improve the liver just enough that the circles dissipate. Still, energy issues and under-eye circles aren't all that dirty blood can cause. Raynaud's syndrome. Raynaud's is a condition that many live with today. Its symptoms include discoloration of the skin, sometimes with tingles and numbness, most often in the extremities. It's a result of poisons from the liver backing up into the bloodstream. That is, dirty blood syndrome. Why doesn't everyone who's chronically dehydrated also have Raynaud's? Because the backlogged poisons in this case are a specific type of troublemaker, viral waste matter. While other troublemakers such as mercury and additional toxic heavy metals can certainly contribute to the liver's struggle, as well as feed the virus so it can create more toxic waste, those presenting with Raynaud's do have a specific resident of the liver, the Epstein-Barr virus, regardless of whether a physician has found and diagnosed EBV in a Raynaud's patient's blood work. The virus is in the body. While much of the EBV might have moved on to the thyroid or beyond, some of it has remained in the liver. You can learn more about antiviral protocols, as well as EBV's viral byproduct, viral corpses, neurotoxins, and dermatoxins in Thyroid Healing. When this waste matter, which contains traces of toxic heavy metals, escapes from the liver, it can hover and float close to the skin, changing the pigment in those areas and creating those dark splotches Raynaud's patients know too well. The thick, dirty blood and viral liver create the circulation issues of Raynaud's, when neurotoxins, dermatoxins, and other troublemakers back up from the liver into the bloodstream, they tend to gravitate to areas of lower circulation. That is, the fingers and toes. And the more poisons in the blood there, the less oxygen. Hence, the discoloration many experience. Tingles and numbness can come about from the rogue neurotoxins congregating in the blood. If someone with Raynaud's is eating a diet that feeds the virus, the symptoms can become severe. While many Raynaud's patients hear that the phenomenon occurs as the result of an autoimmune disease that's causing the body to go haywire, they should hear the truth instead. It's a viral and liver problem, creating a blood problem that can be cleaned up, not the body turning against itself, as the misguided autoimmune theory speculates. Gout. Dirty blood and gout go together like a scarecrow and a cornfield. A knife and a kitchen, a horse and a buggy. If you take away the scarecrow, you'll lose the corn quickly to the birds. Take the knife out of the kitchen and you'll be eating microwave dinners instead of preparing your own meals. Take the horse away from the buggy and you and your date will be stuck freezing in the middle of the street, your romantic jaunt through the cobblestone streets a no-go. What do I mean? Without dirty blood, you won't have gout. Look at gout in its simplest terms, and it's a condition marked by swollen, painful joints, often in the feet and hands. With no antibodies showing up in blood tests to signal RA and no obvious signs of osteoarthritis, medical communities don't know where to go with the symptoms before them. Historically, gout has resulted in many different misdiagnoses. With the gout we identify today, many doctors say that crystals in the synovial fluid of the joints are causing the aggravation and inflammation. Some doctors see crystals as cause for an instant gout diagnosis. Others don't need to see crystals to decide by process of elimination that they're looking at a patient who has the condition. What is gout, really? If everything were working right in the medical field, here's what you'd hear at the doctor's office.
Looks like you've got a liver condition. It appears that you have crystals in your joints, formed from large accumulations of uric acid. Crystals tell us that the liver isn't filtering properly and the kidneys are paying the price. When the blood becomes thick and filled with an overflow of poisons from a dysfunctional liver for far too long, it carries a poisonous load. That is, it's dirty blood. As a result, waste can settle in different areas of your body. The joints are one such place. Because as with Raynaud's syndrome, the joints in farther-reaching points of your body are naturally places of lower circulation. Your joint problem is really a liver problem. So when someone gets a gout diagnosis, it should be a diagnosis of a liver condition. It's puzzling to think that crystals are viewed as the cause of gout when people exhibit the same gout symptoms without crystals present. That's because crystals aren't the cause of gout or the cause of gout's pain. You have to go deeper. While having an improperly working liver doesn't automatically translate to crystals, crystals do automatically translate to an improperly working liver. Crystals are just one component that happens to be found in a big batch of muck, and sometimes they're not there, though plenty of troublemakers still are. If researchers understood the sewage that can fill our blood and then looked for all the poisons that make it up, they'd be dismayed. Suddenly they'd be saying,
"Maybe it's not the crystals. Look at all this toxic sludge that we don't even look for in the lab. The oxidation from heavy metals, the petroleum from pharmaceuticals, the neurotoxins and other viral debris from a pathogen living inside the liver."
Understand that toxins and poisons have weight to them. When they flow to our extremities, they tend to sink and collect there because of their heavy nature. They don't make their way back in the bloodstream so easily, because a liver that's sluggish and dysfunctional results in blood pull back from the extremities that's weaker and slower than the blood push out to them from the heart. If you don't have crystals in the joints, either urate ones or the calcium ones associated with pseudo-gout, and even if you do have crystals, here's what you're supposed to hear from your doctor. "This is viral inflammation of the joints. Viruses love to live inside our livers. They also produce a lot of toxic sludge, which gives the liver even more poisons to handle than it already has to in daily life. It means the liver can't hold on to as much as it would like. So many viruses find their way out of the liver, travelling to the joints and creating pain and inflammation. Even though antibodies aren't showing up in your blood work, what you're really experiencing is a form of RA, where the Epstein-Barr virus has been feeding in a liver filled with troublemakers until it finally escaped to your joints." Many people who have been diagnosed with RA due to antibodies present in the blood also happen to have urate crystals. They're just ignored because of the antibodies. When they can't find an antibody, then they'll call the condition gout. It's a classic case of ignore what you don't see in medicine. Another common symptom that accompanies gout causes confusion, swelling in the extremities. This is not only the joints themselves becoming inflamed, it's fluid retention around the hands, feet, knees, and even elbows. These areas can become painful, and it can occur with or without crystals present in the joints. After a doctor has tested a patient's heart and kidneys and found both to be functioning well enough, the swelling is considered mystery edema. What the patient should be getting is a diagnosis of poor lymphatic circulation due to a stagnant, dysfunctional, compromised liver with lymphatic fluid retention putting pressure on the nerves in various areas of the body. Instead, if elevated enzymes don't show up on a liver test, then no alarm bells ring at the doctor's office. The liver condition stays completely under the radar, both for that doctor and for the broader reach of medical research and science. You'll notice something else interesting about gout, which is that people with gout often have diabetes as well. No one knows why this correlation occurs. Well, the co-occurrence is not a coincidence. As you'll hear in Chapter 15, diabetes is more than a pancreas problem. The liver also plays a pertinent role. Medical communities, if they knew the truth about both gout and diabetes, would put two and two together, realizing that they're both liver problems and therefore interrelated. They'd have to figure out how viruses and toxins work and how the blood becomes filled with these poisons. It would mean medicine would have to expand. People with gout should refrain from eating heavy proteins and fats. The more protein and fat they eat, the more sluggish the liver gets,
and the worse their symptoms become. This has nothing to do with a food belief system. It's purely about what an individual with gout needs in order to heal. Reducing protein and fat in the diet gives gout and pseudo-gout sufferers relief because it gives the liver a chance to recover and clean up the blood. If urate and calcium crystals were present, they'll reduce. Whether or not crystals were a problem, gout symptoms will fade. We must shift our thinking and see crystals only as one road sign that doctors happen to see out of many they can't. It's as though scientists are driving through a fog, and only one deer crossing sign is visible. If the fog lifted, they'd see all of the other road signs: slow, stop, speed limit, detour, one way, do not enter, dead end, merge, construction, blind curve, train crossing, evacuation route, and more, that would help them better navigate the way forward. Varicose veins. When people have varicose veins or spider veins, you'll often hear them sarcastically thank their foremothers and forefathers. We remember relatives having these dark, visible blood vessels in the feet, ankles, legs, often in the calves, torso or arms, and so we think of them as genetic. That's not how it works. At the doctor's office or even the cosmetic surgeon's office, where people often go to get varicose veins removed, this is one more symptom that should instantly be diagnosed as a liver condition, and not a genetic one. It's only because liver troublemakers can be passed down from parent to child that you see this occurring across generations. Within the same family, you can have the same poisons residing in the liver and creating dirty blood. As with the other symptoms and conditions in this chapter, you can have a compromised liver and dirty blood and not develop this issue. And as you'll hear in Chapter 36, Liver Troublemakers, there are so many factors that can clog up a liver. It's the signature toxin cocktail you have that determines how it makes itself known. What really happens when someone develops varicose or spider veins is that their blood has become chronically dehydrated and chronically thick over the years. You'll hear doctors and nurses report times they went to draw blood from a patient and it was so thick that when they removed the needle, the blood strung along with it like molasses or a length of yarn. That's the extreme of chronically thick blood. Even when this doesn't happen, it doesn't mean the blood's not thick. Let's get something straight. We're not talking here or anywhere in this chapter about blood that's thick from an abundance of platelets. This isn't about whether the blood is thin or thick from platelets, whether platelets are causing extra clots, or whether a lack of platelets is causing wounds to bleed. We're not talking about platelet disorders. While they're serious and also deserve attention, they're a separate topic. Platelet issues mean there's a viral infection in the liver and spleen. The thick blood we're talking about here is the type that's thick because it's become chronically dehydrated over the years at the same time the liver has filled with poisons that have backed up into the blood year after year. A higher fat diet, where blood fats are always elevated in the bloodstream with no relief because someone eats 3 high-fat meals a day, often without realizing it, can also contribute to thick blood. This thick blood isn't easy on the vascular system, and so the body adjusts. It realizes that due to its viscosity, the blood is often moving more slowly than it should as it travels through arteries and veins and will eventually cause problems. Not that it's moving slowly all the time. There will be moments where our stress level reduces and we take better care of ourselves and get hydrated, whether we realize it or not. The blood will thin out for a time and flow smoothly, Then, when we get dehydrated again, more toxins will back up from the liver into the bloodstream and the blood will thicken again. When the blood gets thick, our blood vessels tend to narrow slightly because water is the natural expander of our veins. One more reason to stay hydrated throughout life. It keeps veins from constricting. Less water in the blood means the heart must work harder to bring up soupy, toxic, dehydrated blood from the lower extremities, and this increased suction pulls the walls of the veins inward, which makes the movement of blood slower. Slow-moving blood makes the heart work even harder, which in turn puts the brain on alert. To alleviate the heart's strain, the brain calls out for increased blood flow. In response, certain proteins, enzymes, and hormones that are undiscovered by medical research and science start cell production in order to broaden pathways for blood. This spurs the expansion of existing veins and the growth of new ones in what's almost a mutation of your blood vessels. That's when you see those varicose and spider veins appear. They're not a perfect solution, and ultimately they don't solve the problem. What they do is serve as a warning flag for someone to change what she or he is doing and detox the liver in order to clean up the blood. When that happens, it can stop the growth of additional varicose and spider veins, and existing ones can even reduce over time. Inflammation. Inflammation can occur for two different reasons, and sometimes both at once. The first is injury. You fall on ice, you get hit playing sports, or some other accident occurs, and the body will react with inflammation. Invasion is the other reason the body can get inflamed, and in the case of chronic inflammation, the invader is a pathogen. No matter what else you're told out there, these are the two sole reasons for inflammation. You'll frequently hear that chronic inflammation is the result of the body's immune system going after itself. That is, that it's an autoimmune response. That's because medical communities don't yet have the tools to detect just how often viruses such as EBV and HHV6 and bacteria such as strep are present in the body. These invaders, which sometimes also cause injury by damaging tissue, are the real sources of your body's inflammatory responses. The body never attacks itself. Any antibodies present, even if they're labelled autoantibodies, are really there to attack a pathogen and attend to, repair, and heal tissue injured by that pathogen. As you know well by now, the liver is a campground for various pathogens, such as viruses and the poisonous materials that feed them. And of course, viruses will also release their own poisons, such as neurotoxins, which go after the nerves and contribute to inflammation. The virus cells themselves, once escaped from the liver, can also attack different parts of the body. For example, as I detailed in Thyroid Healing, EBV will attack the thyroid, creating the thyroid inflammation known as Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Virus cells will also go after weak spots, which is how you can find yourself with an old injury that either won't heal or flares up for no apparent reason. Say you bang your knee very hard and it swells up, you'll grab a bag of ice to treat the inflammation. In the case of chronic inflammation, your body is also working on ways to bring it down over time. When you lend your hand to the effort by taking a natural approach and eating healthier foods and starting a supplement protocol, the body will respond in kind and you'll notice some results. Seeing inflammation come down as a result of natural foods and supplementation has been an epiphany for so many doctors in recent years.
After witnessing some patients feel better with these changes, they'll write books, spreading the message like gospel. That's great. I commend them for taking initiative with new and back-to-basics approaches. What you need to know for your own health is that these celebrated approaches don't mean that the inflammation won't come back one day, nor do they mean that you'll get the best possible improvements. So far, these professionals' understanding of why a select group of their patients feels better only scratches the surface. It's the tip of the iceberg. The real reason that people get relief in these cases is that picking healthier foods and supplementing with certain nutrients cleans up the liver and the blood. That gives less fuel to viruses and bacteria, and with pathogens faring less well, they can't cause as much inflammation. Pick any random diet that's even quasi-healthy, and inflammation will reduce because it keeps out some of pathogens' favourite fuels, while also letting the liver unburden itself a bit so it can clean up the blood. The thicker and dirtier the blood, the better pathogens can fare and the more inflammation results. The cleaner the blood, the less inflammation you experience. Going gluten-free is a popular part of many anti-inflammatory diets, following the belief that gluten is inherently inflammatory. The real reason it helps is that taking out gluten starves any bacteria or viruses present, because gluten is one of their favourite foods. Medical communities are completely unaware of this because they don't believe that pathogens eat. Yet they do. You'll hear more about pathogenic fuel in Chapter 36, Liver Troublemakers. For real relief that delves beneath the surface to the root of chronic inflammation, The Liver Rescue 369 in Chapter 38 and Antiviral Antibacterial Protocols in Thyroid Healing and Medical Medium are there for you. Insomnia. There are many different causes of insomnia and troubled sleep, which is why I devoted 5 chapters to the secrets of sleep in my book, Thyroid Healing. What's important for you to know here is that the majority of sleep disturbances and insomnia are from dirty blood syndrome. Even if your sleep issues have another cause, an unhappy, burdened, struggling, or weakened liver doesn't help. A few different aspects of dirty blood syndrome affect sleep. For one, there are the poisons present in it. As the blood fills with runoff from toxic heavy metals, oxidizing in your system, virus pollution, by which I mean its waste matter such as byproduct and neurotoxins, pesticides, and other chemicals from the troublemakers list, the brain gets saturated with it, and the brain is essential to a peaceful night's rest. Then there's the liver itself. Like the fine-tuned machine that it is, when it's not firing on all cylinders or functioning at optimum level, it tends to shake, rumble, and roar. Or think of a horse you're riding that's agitated and angry, likely to spook. Either way, you won't get a smooth ride. And that includes in your sleeping hours. In the middle of every night, your liver wakes up, usually crankily, to start working for you, so that in the morning you can cleanse what it's collected through your urine or bowel movements. As your liver begins to fire up to perform this job, it can go into a subtle spasm because of all the toxic matter it has to deal with, both from within itself and from the dirty blood flowing back into it. That spasm can even squeeze some of the poisons it contains back into your blood in unpackaged form, making it dirtier. While it's not a spasm you can feel, the liver's bubble and squeak creates enough of a disturbance in the body that it can wake you up in the wee hours.
Add in the brain disturbances from the toxic matter in the blood, some liver inflammation, some anxiety and hidden post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD from not sleeping well in the past, and maybe a partner snoring beside you or noises outside, and you'll get a good case of insomnia cooking. Tend to your liver, get hydrated, and take dirty blood syndrome out of the recipe, and you'll have a fighting chance of sleep and a whole new relationship with going to bed. A healing well. In some of the chapters to come, you'll hear about other ways that dirty blood can affect your life. You'll see more about how, with all they have coming at them, our livers are overflowing, and how in the process they're losing their neutralization abilities. In Ireland, there's a famous healing well. People have gone there for hundreds of years to get water, a highly active, living water in its most powerful form. It's extremely grounding water with a charge that neutralizes. If you were to dump trash into the well, the water is so potent that at first the well would actually neutralize it. The more garbage and toxic chemicals you threw in, though, the more that neutralization ability would weaken, until it finally died. While there would still be water in the well, it would be dead in ways we couldn't even measure or decipher, because we couldn't measure or decipher its healing mystery in the first place. That deadening is what we're trying to keep the river of your blood from doing, and that means supporting the healing, grounding, neutralizing wonders of your liver. Discovering how to save it from becoming poisoned means learning how to save yourself from dirty, polluted blood. It's one of your greatest lines of defense in life. Chapter 11. Fatty Liver. As we go through life, we eat to survive. Challenging circumstances, which can range from traveling to having limited resources to living with excess stress and pressure to perform, can hold us back from eating the healthiest food. "I'll eat that donut," you may say, because you're on the run trying to keep up with a demanding schedule and out of time to find another option. "I'll have that slice of pizza," you may decide, because it's easy. It's there in the moment. A bagel with cream cheese, a buttered croissant, ice cream as an after-dinner treat, chicken parmesan while out at a restaurant, a hot dog from a stand on the street, or barbecued ribs when your friend is paying. Buffalo chicken wings, shrimp fried rice, a piece of chocolate cake, maybe a fried egg or two, a slice of bacon, a little here, a little there. These are foods that get us by when life is harder and faster than we can keep up with. Whether we know better or not, we eat like this to get by, and we eat like this for happiness. With all we're up against in today's world, it's impossible not to get wound up and emotional. So it's completely understandable that we choose the foods we do for comfort, flavors that satisfy cravings, and even a sense of companionship. Now, what if we're a little more conscious about food? What if we have a little less going on, a little more time to take care of ourselves? What if you're fortunate and have the resources to pursue other ways of eating? We may look to a trendy diet that seems incredibly healthy. We'll go less often for croissants and pizza and ice cream. We'll look for leaner cuts of meat and cut out grains and processed foods. Isn't this the answer? Not as much as we would think when it comes to avoiding fatty liver. Today's trendy diets are still not the choices your liver would make. Our livers are focused on receiving a massive stream of blood, one that needs cleaning, processing, pampering, filtering, testing, measuring, weighing, decoding, and even interrogating,
so that the next 2,000 chemical functions that the liver performs can take place. And this is where your liver's most important concern comes into play. How thick is your blood? The thickness of your blood makes or breaks whether you develop a fatty or pre-fatty liver. What that thickness is harboring determines how fast you'll develop fatty liver. Living and breathing. Why is blood thickness the deal breaker? Why does it mean everything? Because the thicker the blood, the less oxygen can reside in it. The less oxygen in the blood that goes to the liver, the more trouble the liver has breathing. Yes, your liver breathes, and in order to respect that, we can picture the liver as a set of lungs, with the left lobe the left lung and the right lobe the right lung. Another way to envision the liver is as a sea urchin living in the depths of the ocean, extracting oxygen from the sea water. If the thickness of the blood holds a host of toxic particles, it will make the liver's breathing even harder. As a result, its life force will weaken. Think of yourself trying to breathe in an environment where the air is very dirty, smoky, or smoggy. Maybe as you walk down the street, someone in front of you is puffing on a cigarette, or maybe there's a forest fire near your home that's filling the air with ash. It will make it difficult to breathe. For people who are sensitive or asthmatic, air quality means everything. And a hot, humid day with an elevation of air pollution or a stuffy room at work with toxic scents in the air matters both to someone with sensitive lungs and to someone with no sensitivities. Now imagine your liver as your lungs and your blood crowded with pollutants. Poor air quality is just like the strain that thick blood creates. When the blood has a high blood fat ratio thickening it up, it's a concern. High blood fat is not really on the radar of medical research and science. Determining healthy ratios of blood fat is not a concern on anybody's agenda, whether researchers, doctors, dietitians, or nutritionists, and that's a serious oversight. There's no way to measure it accurately in today's world. You can't hop on a scale like you do to measure your weight, or have your skin pinched with an instrument like you do to measure body fat percentage. What I'm talking about is different from today's testing for triglycerides and cholesterol. You could go to your doctor's office for a full physical and have everything check out fine. The stress test, your weight, your heart rate and other vitals, the sound of your lungs, even a blood panel. All the while experiencing a high blood fat ratio that never gets detected. What physicians need at their disposal is a simple blood test that can be administered on the spot to determine blood fat levels, like the kind used to measure blood glucose levels in diabetics. It should be a routine part of any physical exam, so that a doctor can instantly say, "Wow, what was your last meal? Your blood fat is off the charts. At this rate, you're going to develop fatty liver, gout or heart disease in 10 years, or even experience a heart attack." Let's say it's Noah at the doctor for his physical. Ideally, the doctor would engage him in a dialogue. "So, Noah, what did you eat for dinner last night?" "I ate out at a restaurant and ordered chicken with broccoli." "What was yesterday's lunch?" "A turkey club on gluten-free bread." "And how about yesterday's breakfast?" "I had 2 eggs with bacon and skipped the toast because I decided to have a carb-free morning." The doctor would lean forward. "Noah, that's great you skipped the toast. What we really need to be concerned with is how much fat is in your diet. A simple blood test is showing high fat in your bloodstream, and your recap of recent meals is indicating that it's consistently high.
This will end up starving your liver of oxygen, setting the stage for illness and disease. You don't have to eat wheat, nor should you really, though you do need to consider bringing more fruit into your diet, along with other healthy carbohydrates and additional vegetables or leafy greens. That's how the medical world should work on planet Earth. Concern shouldn't always focus on sugar and carbs, to the point that vital foods such as fruit get eliminated from the diet. Sadly, blaming sugar as the cause of fatty liver is a huge mistake in the health industry right now. This mistake exists because sugar is never eaten on its own. It's always eaten with or very closely before or after fat, and nearly always an unhealthy fat at that. And that's what causes health issues. Fat's the problem. No one's sitting around eating gobs of standalone sugar. They're mixing it in coffee with cream. They're having it in cakes, cookies, and pastries. It's in the barbecue sauce that they use to coat their pulled pork. It's eaten as a treat, such as a candy cane after a high-fat festive meal. Not acknowledging that sugar is always consumed with fat is a prime example of both the conventional medical and alternative health industries operating with blinders on. They have tunnel vision that only allows sugar into view, and when a theory is seen from that limited perspective, it easily becomes law. You can think of the roles of fat and sugar in fatty liver like this. Say you, sugar, were driving along with a friend, fat, when suddenly she pulled in front of a bank, took out a gun and ran inside. For a moment you'd be paralysed. Finally you'd get your wits about you and hop in the driver's seat, just as your friend ran back out with a sack of cash and tossed it through an open window. When police arrived at the scene, they'd see you behind the wheel of the getaway car, and at the time of sentencing, you'd get blamed for the entire operation, as though your friend had never been there. You wouldn't want to be framed for a crime you neither masterminded nor committed any more than sugar should get the blame for causing fatty liver. Thicker than water. Less oxygen makes such a big difference to the liver because the river of blood that enters the liver from the digestive system is already lower in oxygen to begin with. It's not possible to lock down a standard oxygen percentage of blood entering the liver because it depends on what someone's eating, when they're eating, how long they've been on a certain diet, how many toxin obstacles they're up against, what time of day it is, and what day of the week. Any named standards are arbitrary. Much of the rest of the blood entering through the hepatic portal vein is in need of filtering and processing because it's full of toxins, pathogens, pharmaceuticals, minerals, vitamins, enzymes, amino acids, antioxidants, other phytochemicals and nutrients, fats, and more. For many people, the amount of toxins coming in is high, which makes the liver's job harder. Often, too, the ratio of nutrients is low, which is another strike against us. These two factors are manageable, however, if the blood is thin enough. Yet again, here's what pushes the liver over the edge. High blood fat. Fat thickens the blood enough on its own, resulting in lower water content, at which point someone can become chronically dehydrated for many years. Imagine someone who barely drinks any water, aside from the water in a cup of coffee, a can of soda, an energy drink, wine, beer, or caffeinated tea. When someone's in this position of not drinking water or fresh juices, dehydration is even worse, which thickens the blood even more. This opens the door to strokes, heart attacks, kidney damage, high blood pressure, adrenal fatigue, and elevated cholesterol,
as well as any central nervous system symptoms and conditions worsening along the way. What does it mean for the central nervous system to worsen? Well, say you're dealing with ME/CFS. Tingles and numbness, aches and pains, balance issues such as vertigo, restless leg syndrome, anxiety or depression. These are all central nervous system-related symptoms, and they can worsen with lower oxygen levels and higher blood fat. What's even more important to understand is that every single autoimmune condition that someone may be labelled with can worsen with higher blood fat and lower oxygen levels. That's because the pathogens that are the real cause of autoimmune conditions, as well as the cause of many other diseases and health issues, can grow, proliferate, and expand with higher blood fat, causing the illnesses to worsen. Sure, you may experience symptom improvements on a high-fat, low-carb diet because you're subtracting gluten, dairy, and processed foods that feed pathogens. It's still not the answer to getting 100% better. Meanwhile, well-meaning doctors and other practitioners put autoimmune patients on a high-fat, low-carb diet in hopes that it will stop what they believe to be the body attacking itself, never realizing that the higher blood fat actually allows viruses and bacteria that are off their radar to prosper, meaning that someone's lupus, Hashimoto's, RA, and more worsen. In truth, most fatty livers have a pathogen living inside the liver, contributing to its sluggishness, and constant high blood fat does not help it. Blood fat cycling higher also diminishes oxygen levels even more, slowly aging and even killing the liver, which in turn quickly ages you. As long as a seemingly new, trendy, everyday diet consists of higher levels of fat as the main calorie source, it will burden the liver, possibly resulting in an undiagnosed pre-fatty or fatty liver condition. Regardless of whether someone is exercising regularly and maintaining a healthy weight, exercise and weight don't determine pre-fatty or fatty liver. Rather, it's about what the liver is up against in the river of blood running through it, and how hard your liver must work to protect your pancreas, heart, brain, and the rest of your body. Sacrifices for survival. Our livers can sense what we eat. While you would think your stomach can too, it can't. Your stomach doesn't have its own intelligence. It's just a pouch that gets its marching orders from your brain, which communicates through various nerves, such as the vagus, as well as smaller nerves. Your stomach is an important tool, and it is well respected by your liver and pancreas, treated with more kindness by your liver than the kindness we pay our stomachs. Still, the stomach is not a very smart organ, nor is it supposed to be. If it were smart, it would punish us every time we ate foods we shouldn't eat. In a way, maybe that would be a good thing. It would warn us instantly with every unproductive food and reward us with every food that helps us. That wouldn't give us freedom, though, and the stomach's role is to grant us freedom. While the liver and pancreas can remain responsible, the stomach is supposed to give us leeway, because the world is so difficult. So many of us don't have many options in what we eat, whether because of an area of the country or world where we live, or because of our resources. For that reason, the stomach doesn't punish us. It's there as a buffer to protect us, and the liver and pancreas care about it like a craftsman cares about her best set of tools in the workshop. As fats enter the mouth, in whatever form of food or drink, the liver instantly starts to eject bile in order to be able to break down those fats as quickly as possible. For one, it wants to disperse the fats to make the passage of our blood easier for our vascular system. Secondly, it wants to thin out the blood before it gets to the liver. If the liver senses that the fat content of a meal is high, this bile production becomes extreme. And if this happens over time, the liver starts to weaken, unable to perform this job as well, and as a result, rogue, undispersed fats enter the liver continually. Because the liver will do anything to protect you and your pancreas, it starts taking on those fats. It's why the liver is the first part of the body to become fatty or heavy. Before a person develops any sort of weight problem that can be detected by outward looks or a number on the scale, that person's liver develops a spare tire or muffin top. The pancreas also suffers when the liver is in trouble like this. If your liver has any issues at all, you're going to be much more prone to pancreatitis, as well as have a harder time recovering from it. Many people live with chronic pancreas problems, and I'm not just talking about diabetics. So many individuals live with chronic inflammatory pancreas issues that they may or may not even realize they have. For any pancreas issue whatsoever, the liver is really important to straightening it out so you can get better, heal and regain full pancreas function. Taking on fats due to a high blood fat ratio for years, the liver weakens further, unable to disperse and eliminate fats as it should, and as that happens, it becomes sluggish and starts to break down. Its ability to draw nutrients out of the blood becomes compromised, and many of these vital nutrients can end up trapped in the fat cells, inaccessible. Toxins, too, become harder for the liver to collect and process out, so many of them get lodged in the fat stored in and around the liver, along with those nutrients. The liver slowly becomes imprisoned by fat, developing into a pre-fatty and then a fatty liver. This fate can be avoided or reversed. If we lower our fat intake, regardless of what dietary belief system we subscribe to, because lowering fat helps the liver get stronger and improve bile production. You get a second chance with that better bile able to dissolve and break down fats to free you. Certain healing herbs and foods, such as ginger, can assist you with that. More in Chapter 37. Otherwise, with the blood thick from high fat levels, bile production weakened and fats in the blood unable to disperse, the intrusion of fat pouring through the hepatic portal vein especially, as well as from the hepatic artery, since the liver can't filter out all the excess fat that comes through the portal vein, so it comes back later, is equivalent to an avalanche in the Alps, with hundreds of skiers caught on the slopes, like the chemical functions that your liver performs being caught in the path of too much fat. As the snow cascades, some skiers will crawl out and ski away from danger, while others will be helpless, frozen forever. Which is to say that the liver will fight for some of its most important chemical functions to stay intact, propelling out whatever chemicals it can to save you. It's sort of like how if you were skiing with a child when the avalanche came, you'd do anything you could to push the child towards safety before you sacrificed yourself and got buried by snow. One of your liver's sacrifices can be weight gain. Chapter 12. Weight Gain. If you were to ask 1,000 health and fitness professionals why someone was overweight, the majority would answer, slow metabolism. With the close runners-up being, eats too much, eats too many carbs, and doesn't exercise enough. They're the answers you've heard before, whether from doctors, trainers, family, friends, headlines, or the nightly news. And yet, if you're the one struggling with your weight, you know that it's not a simple formula. It's merely the stereotype that when people are overweight, it's because they love food, overindulging in fried items, sweets and other treats, while spending too much time on the couch. This isn't based on an accurate perception of what those who deal with mystery weight gain are really up against. It's often not a straightforward matter of expending more calories than you consume. You've likely tried tracking calories and found it both crazy-making and ineffectual. It's probably felt awful to think that you were born with an inadequate metabolism while your neighbour or co-worker or best friend hit the jackpot. There's a tremendous amount of non-compassion and downright cruelty in how people view those who are overweight or obese, and in how they view themselves. It's time for the world to understand what mystery weight gain really is, and the first step is understanding what it isn't. Not about eating too many carbs, or being lazy, or lacking self-control. Not caused by hypothyroidism or polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, though both of these conditions can be a sign of future weight problems. And not a result of a slow metabolism, because there's no such thing as a fast or slow metabolism. This last one may come as a shock, since we're conditioned to believe in metabolism as a well-understood medical fact. We've grown up hearing the word used as though it's a rock-solid law of the universe, when the truth is that metabolism is nothing more than the antiquated discovery that the body is a living organism that assimilates food and uses it for energy. Telling people that a slow metabolism is the reason they have trouble losing or keeping off weight isn't a real answer. It usually leads to despair, making people feel like they were born with faulty bodies and they're stuck that way for life. The reality is that many of the mechanics of how the body gains and loses weight remain medical mysteries, and metabolism is merely a convenient label. There's so much more to know. The liver's starring role. What is weight gain really about? You won't be surprised by now to hear that most of the time, an overwhelming amount of the time, weight gain is really about the liver. While two other factors, the thyroid and the adrenals, can often be involved, it's important to remember that they both lead back to the liver. Let's look at how that works. The thyroid-liver link. It's trendy right now to blame weight gain on the thyroid. Yet, as I revealed in detail in Thyroid Healing, a thyroid problem does not cause weight gain. There are thousands of people in the US alone, never mind globally, who have a thyroid disorder and still maintain what we'd call an average weight. It's true that many others with thyroid disorders do gain weight, whether long before a diagnosis, at the time of diagnosis or later on. That correlation should not be mistaken for causation. Whether someone has a hypothyroid or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, or even if the thyroid was killed off or removed, the gland is not to blame. Healthcare professionals started linking the thyroid with weight trouble because the thyroid is believed to be the body's metabolism regulator. Notice that word, believed? Again, metabolism is only a theory that's been repeated so often it sounds like fact. How the thyroid truly works is also not fully understood by medical research and science. So you've got the metabolism myth to begin with, and then it's combined with the mysteries of the thyroid. That's not an equation that somehow leads to a conclusive answer. Two unknowns don't make a known. Here's why you'll see a correlation between thyroid issues and weight gain. Because thyroid issues are viral over 95% of the time, and chronic viral infection weakens and burdens the liver, in part because the virus that causes thyroid problems nests in the liver on its way to the thyroid. When the liver gets damaged by viral activity and overloaded with its waste matter, it can't filter as it's meant to, which leads to eventual weight gain. We'll examine how in more depth in just a bit. Body temperature fluctuations, brain fog, weight coming on in the middle of the body, while we're led to believe they're thyroid caused, the truth is they have liver stamped all over them. If you've dealt with a thyroid condition and a weight problem side by side, it's because they're both symptoms of the same underlying viral issue. It's not the thyroid itself causing weight gain. You'll find much more on this topic in Thyroid Healing. The adrenal liver link. The adrenal glands, they're getting a lot more attention than they did just a few years ago. In some ways, that's great. It means patients' struggles are being taken more seriously, and medical communities are more driven than ever to acknowledge the interconnectedness of the human body. Compassionate practitioners should be applauded for searching far and wide for ideas that they think can help their patients. Here's where we need to be careful. Taking another part of the anatomy, the adrenals, that's not yet fully understood by medical research and science, and using the leeway of that mystery to throw as much as possible under its umbrella. Fatigue, difficulty focusing, depression, anxiety, insomnia. Call it all adrenal, goes some current thinking. Because the adrenal glands are still being explored, it seems just as plausible as not to attribute a health issue to them. Weight gain is yet one more item being thrown under the umbrella of the adrenal label. Adrenal fatigue, elevated cortisol, high cholesterol, hormonal imbalance, they're all being blamed for slowing down someone's metabolism so that she or he holds on to a spare tire, regardless of exercise. This theory is not accurate. This is another situation where there is a real correlation going on, only it's not the direct causation it appears to be. And again, it's certainly not a slowing down of the metabolism, since metabolism really doesn't explain weight gain or loss. In truth, it's the level of excess adrenaline we're faced with that sets off a chain reaction that can lead to weight gain. That reaction begins with the stress and overstimulation of our non-stop lives, as you'll hear more about in Chapter 19, Adrenal Problems. Your liver initiates a remarkable shielding process when your precious adrenal gland